I'm Greya, and this is The Climate Question, where we ask simply, what on earth can we do about climate change? Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It's mid-March 2022 in New Delhi, India.
And city dwellers are celebrating, for it's the festival of Holi, the festival of colours, love and spring.
Except that spring was like no other.
Outdoors in northern India is like the inside of an oven.
The temperature has risen to 45 degrees Celsius in some places.
The country's already experienced its hottest March since records began more than 120 years ago.
Overheated birds dropped out of the sky. Crops wilted and died in these extreme temperatures.
But this isn't just about jaw-dropping temperatures. India is home to nearly 1.5 billion people, close to a fifth of the world's population, many of whom couldn't afford to stop working in these life-threatening conditions. In the end, dozens were killed, all because of a heat wave.
A study shows that climate change made this heat wave 30 times more likely.
If we don't keep global warming in check, and the indications are we're not at the moment, expect hotter heat waves more often and more deaths.
Heat waves are already the deadliest of all climate risks.
So, more than floods, hurricanes, sea level rise, or droughts.
And yet, some say keeping cool is a critical blind spot in the fight against climate change.
Last week on The Climate Question, we looked at heating. This week, we're asking, how can we stay cool?
I'm Greg Jackson.
And I'm Luke Jones.
My name is Zarin Osho. I'm basically an international climate law and policy expert working with the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. And I live and work essentially out of Washington, D.C. and New Delhi.
And I'm right in saying also you're a Climate Question listener, Zarin.
Yes, I am. I love the show and I started tuning in a few years ago when I was still at grad school in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, you're already our favourite guest.
Now, Zarin talked to us about how heat waves,
like the one we saw in March,
they test humans' survivability.
Over the last 50 years, heat waves have killed 17,000 people in India.
Shocking, isn't it? And Zarin also pointed to a World Bank report that showed there could be huge economic losses associated with heat waves too.
Exactly. We have a lot of people, for example, out in the streets selling vegetables on a cart. How do you expect people in the unskilled labor force of India, or, you know, an auto wala or a rickshaw wala, to go out in the middle of the day and earn the money that he or she has to when the temperatures are going to be more than 50 degrees centigrade? How do kids go to school? Schools are not air-conditioned. There are very few schools that are air-conditioned. But essentially the dialogue is that you're looking at cooling not anymore from the lens of luxury, but as a means to live. It's now becoming a necessity for human survival as we know it. In fact, India and the state of Delhi, unfortunately, the national capital, home to more than 20 million people, is going to be the first where temperatures of above 50 degrees centigrade are going to be experienced. And this, they have calculated, is going to cost about 100 plus billion hours of productive work hours and impacts the Indian GDP at 4.5% roughly.
A 4.5% hit to GDP, that is quite the blow to the economy when you think about how for the last few years it's been growing in India by half that a year.
Yeah, and I imagine it's not just India that will feel these effects. Heatwaves, of course, are happening around the world.
The International Energy Agency thinks cooling needs are expected to triple by 2050.
And to put that into context, I've read that that's the equivalent of adding 10 new air conditioning units every single second for the next 30 years.
So those are the raw numbers. Let's see what the lived experience is.
I'm Chavi Sachdev. I'm in Mumbai, India.
What's the weather like where you are? Very British question, but very relevant for our programme, conveniently.
Nobody has ever talked about the weather quite this much in Mumbai because it's usually unremarkable. Mumbai is tropical. We're by the Arabian Sea. We never get really cold. It's like the Florida of India. But it has been so warm. I had my air conditioning service people come in today. It's January. And in the normal course of events, I would not have known for another 4 months that my ACs were not working because I never have to turn them on. It's so hot, I have been turning on my air conditioners. For a lot of people, air conditioning is very aspirational. We are seeing a rise in our middle class. There is more access to disposable income. And every day, people are buying their first air conditioners. They're moving on from fans if they have them. It's getting really, really essential and hard to live without. I'm standing outside an electronics store in Mumbai, and it's a Sunday evening. It's balmy out, very noisy. There's a lot of traffic, and there are a lot of people going into the store as well. It's a good day for shopping. This shop floor has fans, air conditioners, and refrigerators, as well as vacuum cleaners. On the wall behind me are 11 rows of air conditioners, four deep, gleaming white, of every brand you can think of. The area I'm in has a lot of new construction coming up, so a lot of clients are buying fresh air conditioners for a new apartment.
They're renovating their house, he says.
And they're looking at air conditioning options.
The deciding factor, though...
Energy rating,
the man says, we look at the price.
Not the rating that shows how energy efficient they are.
They are certainly more affordable than they used to be even a decade ago. The issue is that the five-star energy efficient air conditioners cost about 15% more than the three-star air conditioners. So even for people who are motivated to help with the environment or offset their carbon footprint, it's a difficult decision because it is so much more expensive. So they choose to go with the middle ground, which is the three-star rating. And that's something that the assistant manager at the store also told me. In fact, I overheard their sales spiel, and they were clearly steering people towards the three-star and saying that it's good enough.
Did you challenge them on that? What did they say?
I did. And they acknowledged it, that yes, it's not ideal. But then they had counter-arguments, and they actually said that, you know, the energy efficiency rating gets upgraded every year. You can't keep up. And I guess they felt they were doing their bit by at least giving people the option of the three-star rating.
Oh, OK, so does that mean they get more stringent every year?
They do.
But whatever the energy efficiency, it still is using energy to cool people and their homes down.
Cooling is one of the biggest contributors to climate change.
Yeah, Zarin's right. Today, refrigeration and air conditioning creates 10% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions.
If left unchecked, emissions are expected to double by 2030 and triple by 2100.
That's according to the International Energy Agency.
You're suddenly dealing with exponentially high energy demand from air conditioning units that are added. So that's what the problem of numbers does.
And I suppose that's problematic because the majority of our electricity is generated by burning fossil fuels, which contribute to global warming, right?
Absolutely. So if you don't manage the energy demand from air conditioning, you're looking at a scenario where you're completely blowing through any of the carbon budgets that people talk about.
And it's not purely the electricity demand that's a problem. It's also the refrigerants used in air conditioners or fridges, you know, these HFCs.
Yes.
Why are they so bad for the climate?
Any air conditioner that you use has a refrigerant gas in it, and that gas tends to leak. Now, in most cases, the refrigerant gas are hydrofluorocarbons, they're extremely potent greenhouse gases, meaning that their global warming potential is several thousand times more than that of CO2, carbon dioxide. And when you leak those, they alone were capable of producing 0.4 degrees centigrade temperature rise.
0.4 degrees, is that actually that much?
Yeah, think about it, right? So since we started burning fossil fuels 150 years ago, temperatures have risen by about 1 degree Celsius.
Oh gosh, so almost half. So yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah, and think about all these horrible natural disasters we've seen in the last few years caused by just 1 degree rise in temperature, the floods in Pakistan, or those bushfires we've seen in Australia. Those sorts of events have been made much more likely.
And to make matters worse, we're still making buildings that require a lot of air conditioning. So says our next guest, Karim El-Gendi. He's based at the think tank Chatham House, as well as the engineering consultancy firm Burrow Happold in the UK.
We found innumerable examples of buildings that are fully glazed, designed to maximise solar radiation rather than reduce it, and as a result have ended up needed to spend ridiculous amounts of energy and money in order to cool them as a result.
Because so much sun is coming through the windows and is just heating the building, like sitting in a huge greenhouse.
Yes. This particular model of commercial buildings and office buildings has emerged in northern European cities, and it came from the need to provide as much daylighting as possible. And as a result, that model of highly glazed, super insulated buildings became quite successful across northern Europe. And the thing that happened is that cities in other parts of the world found that to be interesting. It represented progress to them, and they replicated that regardless of whether it's applicable to their environment or not.
They basically just liked the look of it and wanted to copy it. And how energy intensive is it to actually cool those buildings?
The estimates are, in some of those Gulf cities, that in the summer, cooling requirements are in range of 60 to 70% of all energy use.
So thinking about some of the places that you've worked, you mentioned the Gulf region, for example. Ballpark guess, what percentage of buildings there do you think are suited to the climate that they're in?
I would say less than 5%.
Gosh, okay.
That is pretty bonkers. Big glass greenhouses are being built in boiling hot countries.
Those countries are going to get hotter thanks to climate change.
So they're going to need a lot more air conditioning to keep everyone inside cool, aren't they?
And that means more fossil fuels are going to be burnt to power them.
And let's not forget the units themselves leak potent planet-warming gases.
Which again adds to more global warming.
Which means more air conditioning units are needed.
We're on repeat.
It's a cyclical process, and somebody needs to break it.
Somebody or something? Experts we spoke to all agree that the solution lies in something called passive cooling.
What's that?
Zarin knows.
Yes. So the passive ways essentially include improvements in building design. How do you create a building envelope that essentially helps you reduce temperatures inside any given building? So that has to do with the construction materials you're using. Simple design elements, for example, coloring your roof white has such an impact on the overall temperatures inside the building.
Really? Just painting it? Just painting the roof?
Exactly.
Because it reflects the sunlight, right? That's the thinking.
Correct. Once it increases the reflective index of a building, the temperatures automatically reduce. The other passive ways is how do you reduce humidity? Sometimes you can just get away with a dehumidifier. How do you channel wind into a building? So how do you adopt for more architectural improvements in any given building that you're dealing with?
Because this isn't exactly new, is it? Surely humans have put up with this problem for thousands of years to some extent before air conditioning was invented, something Karim studies.
Humans have lived and they have adapted to a certain extent, and they have developed buildings and environments that were environmentally responsive. And there are many of those measures that are really intelligent, albeit very simple.
In what kind of things?
So some of them are as simple as shading. How is shading deployed in a way that allows light in but keeps the sun out? Some of them relied on principles such as evaporative cooling. So, for example, using water fountains and courtyards in a way that allows water to evaporate. And as it does, it draws temperature from the surrounding air and creates a slightly cooler environment. The use of vegetation, which improves the temperature. So some of them learned basic physics principles and applied them to buildings.
And if you picture it now in your mind, you can see how that would work and how that would be cool if you compare the huge glass skyscrapers that Karim was telling us about and then think, well, swap that with something where the windows are open, there are fountains causing water to evaporate, which will cool you. There's vegetation and trees. I'm seeing leaves wafting in the wind. It seems a lot more chill.
And you know what? I've got experience of this and it really, really works. I remember we were in Morocco, really hot day, 40 plus degrees, driving all day. We pulled up at where we were staying for the night, walked in, and it was honestly about 10 degrees cooler. And they had all the things that you've just been describing. And I can't help but think that's why it was so much cooler in there.
So the idea is that if you want to cool your home or your office, your Moroccan hotel, whatever it is, do it as much as you can with these kind of solutions, these passive solutions. And then once you've exhausted all of that, and maybe it's still too hot, that's when you bring in the air conditioning to top it up.
Yeah, but the thing is, this isn't happening. Architects and developers skip the passive cooling. And so the only option for people is to buy aircon.
So why isn't passive cooling used more?
I think it's inertia. The market has gotten used to building in a certain way, and it wants to continue building in that way. It doesn't want to change anything. It doesn't want to do anything different. Why do anything different if the profit margins have been steady over the last 50 years?
That suggests we need regulations that make climate-proof buildings more profitable.
And Zarin agrees.
Essentially, that change in the policy and in the discussions around managing cooling demand has to happen globally. It is happening in several pockets, but it needs to happen at a systemic level. And if we added building codes on top of that, that is how you solve this and move forward.
Why aren't they? What's the biggest barrier facing policy change that makes sustainable cooling widespread?
I mean, the short answer to that is capitalism. And the longer one is, it's not that it's not happening. It's very much happening. But agreements take time. Consensus building takes time.
There is, however, hope.
In 2016, 145 countries signed the Kigali Agreement. It said HFCs, these potent planet-warming refrigerant gases, the ones that Zarin talked about before, they'll be phased out by 2047 and replaced with climate-friendly alternatives.
Okay, that's good. Positive news.
Yeah, and remember, that's going to save us from 0.4 degrees Celsius of warming. It's like low-hanging fruit.
And on top of that, if we focus back on India, India's committed to be carbon neutral by 2070, so that means the majority of its energy will come from low carbon sources like renewables, so it will be green energy powering all these millions of air conditioning units.
Exactly. I have a but, though.
You always do.
So there's evidence to suggest that the demand for aircon is projected to way outstrip the amount of renewable energy we're installing.
So that really underlines the need for some of these passive cooling measures.
Yeah, it does. And remember, lots of people can't afford aircon anyway.
Like the people Chavi met in Mumbai.
I talked to Alka, who is a cook. She goes from house to house in the same neighbourhood, making lunch and dinner for families, and it is pretty hot.
Alka tells Chavi that she has a small room with a ceiling fan. She can't afford air conditioning. The bills are just too high for a cook, she says.
Sanjay, who is the freelance ironing man in my neighbourhood, lives in basically a tin roof shack. And they have no air conditioning.
Original AC.
Original AC.
Sanjay jokes that he has natural air conditioning.
Which means, you know, they just get on with life. They don't really have an option.
It's not about not wanting or needing it, he says. For now, it doesn't fit his budget.
How do they cope in those extreme temperatures where you're seeing something like 40, 50 plus degrees?
So a lot of people go to malls and hang out. I've seen that a lot, or coffee shops, which are air conditioned, and who can blame them? Other people have other tricks. For instance, you can rinse a sheet and wring it out so it's damp but not wet, and then put it over your body. So as it dries at night, the water evaporates. You are a little cooler than you would be otherwise. And yeah, otherwise you just grin and bear it. Or don't grin and bear it, just bear it. So Sanjay was reminiscing about how when he grew up in the north, where it's very, very hot, even now, he had tons of shade to play under, lots of trees and a pond that all the children used to swim in. And he says, there are no trees anymore, no rain. The pond is gone. There is no swimming at all. And he says that everybody there understands that felling these trees is going to cause problems. When there is no trees, they all understand there will be no rain and it's just going to get hotter and hotter. They're totally cognizant of the effects, but they continue to do it.
Sanjay's not wrong.
So many of the issues around climate change have a similar format to what we've just heard, don't they? The problem is there and it's getting clearer and clearer. There are solutions that we know could help in some way.
Yeah, simple things that require no energy. Proof that we can live comfortably without harming the climate.
And yet still, the policy, the regulation, the incentives for people aren't there to actually make it happen.
Everyone we spoke to thinks that cooling, and not just our homes, but refrigeration of food and vaccines and data centres, this is a critical blind spot in the fight against climate change.
Let's send some climate news. And, well, as we've done in the past on this programme, Greya, and let's talk about HSBC, the bank, because cast your mind back. People remember hearing on this programme about this pledge that HSBC made to not put any funding into new oil and gas projects. Now there's been a new twist in what they've been putting their money into.
Yeah, so the Bureau of Investigative Journalism has found that HSBC is funding the expansion of a coal mine in Germany, and they're demolishing several villages along the way. So that gives you a sense of scale of how big this is, right? And the important thing to remember is that coal is the dirtiest of all fossil fuels. And then the bank said it would, quote, not provide finance to any client for the specific purposes of activities that HSBC considers incompatible with their net zero goals. But this would include new thermal coal infrastructure. So it seems slightly at odds with what they've committed to then find that they're providing this mine with $340 million. That's not to say, though, there are other banks involved, 24 other, in fact, according to the Bureau.
Well, that's interesting lifting of the curtain to see what's actually been happening behind the scenes. One of these bankers at HSBC talking to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, obviously asking to remain anonymous, saying that the approach was, quote, questionable, and that HSBC appeared to be happy to provide the funds but didn't want any of this publicity that would be associated with it.
Yeah, and it's important to note that HSBC have responded to this and they deny these claims. They say that the details of this deal and all its participating banks are in the public domain, which is normal, and they have these processes to ensure that all our financing aligns with their policies, which includes an expectation on clients to produce and implement credible transition plans.
Okay, let's move on to another topic in this week's climate news because, well, COP27 in Egypt is barely a distant memory and people are already arguing over COP28. This is the next big UN climate conference. It's going to happen in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And there's a bit of upset about the person who's going to be in charge of it, or would you say presiding over it? They're the president of COP28.
Yeah, so the job of the president is sort of to oversee all the talks and to drive change. So their job is to fly all the way around the world and sort of set the groundwork for commitments, which is then finalised at COP in November, right? And UAE have already been criticised for being able to hold COP, right? Because they're one of the biggest producers of oil and gas. Now, the next bit of controversy that's come out from that is, as you say, the person who's going to run these talks. Many people are really shocked by their choice. It's Sultan Al Jaber. He's the chief executive officer of one of the biggest oil firms in the world, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. And campaigners say this is like a major conflict of interest, right?
And one of them quoted in a statement is Tasneem Essop, who is executive director of the Climate Action Network International, not pulling their punches, saying this is a conflict of interest, that Al Jaber's presidency of COP28 was, quote, tantamount to a full-scale capture of the UN climate talks by a petrostate national oil company and its associated fossil fuel lobbyists. For his part, Al Jaber says that the UAE is approaching COP28 with a strong sense of responsibility and the highest possible level of ambition. He continued, quote, we will bring a pragmatic, realistic and solutions-orientated approach that delivers transformative progress for the climate and low-carbon economic growth.
And I think the other thing to say here is that because of his role in Abu Dhabi's renewable energy firm, Masqar, some say that he does have green credentials and therefore is a good candidate to be leading these COP talks.
Well, there's plenty of time until that conference actually gets underway, and I'm sure there'll be many more arguments before we get to it. But yeah, that latest news about COP28. Now, if you have got a question you'd like us to answer on the programme, you can get in touch anytime you like. You can send an email to theclimatequestion@bbc.com.
Yeah, and if you'd like to send us a voice note with your question, you might just hear yourself on the show.
That is all for this week. Thank you to our producer, Lily Freeston, researcher, Natasha Fernandez.
Production coordinators, Sophie Hill and Siobhan Reed. The series producer is Alex Lewis and the editor is China Collins. Finally, the man with the magic fingers who makes the mix is Tom Brignall.
The Comb is back, bringing you more voices and more stories from across Africa.
Need a comb.
The Comb.
The Comb.
It was a moment that was filled with hope.
It was emotional. I stepped aside and I cried.
It was a very life-changing experience.
Each week we look into a single African story that matters.
I've learned to embrace my mistakes.
I can find closure in a lot of things.
From a Ugandan refugee facing an uncertain future.
Safety, security. Give somebody a plan.
To a Cameroonian woman battling to bring back a sacred statue.
It's about Africa's heritage.
We are like children who don't know their mother.
That's The Comb from the BBC World Service.
The Comb.
Just search for The Comb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.